How do you want to be remembered? What is the legacy that you want to build or leave? Perhaps that's not a question you ask yourself at this point in your life. Perhaps that is a question that one considers more in the last half of one's life than in the first half. But it can also be asked this way: what kind of an impact do you want to have on the world and the people around you? Because, you know, for some folks, it's all about legacy, right? They want their name on something. And that drives a lot of philanthropy in this world, right? For some folks, that's just important. Carnegie Hall, the Galisano Children's Hospital. It's not everyone's style, and yet Carnegie Hall is wonderful. And think how many children and families have been helped at that hospital since that gift. Just because something is an ego boost doesn't necessarily make it bad. But for many people, it isn't about the recognition. It is about the relationships. That is what they want to be remembered for. I found a TED Talk the other day by David Brooks, and he speaks exactly to this. And he talks about resume virtues and eulogy virtues. And he said, the eulogy virtues are the ones that get mentioned in the eulogy, which are deeper. Who are you? In your depth, what is the nature of your relationships? Are you bold, loving, dependable, consistent? And he goes on to say, and most of us, including me, would say that the eulogy virtues are more important of the virtues. But in his case, he says, are they the ones that I think about the most? No. Now think about that. Really think about how that plays out in this world. Think about what we say to youth who are in high school, who are considering college and trying to figure out how to get there. What questions do we ask them? What are you going to do to make your high school resume look and record look good for college? You should go out for a sport, get good grades, do some volunteering so you can get into college. Not do some volunteering because that's a good thing to do. We do not say to them, you should really develop yourself into the best human being you can be. Find your emotional depth. Develop a good moral compass. That's what will get you into college. We live in a culture that values highly the resume. What do you do? Meaning, what do you do for work? Your resume, the better it is, the more valuable you are. And I don't know that that's necessarily bad, but it is one-sided. Joseph, someday I'm going to pick my authors based on whether or not I can pronounce their names. Joseph Salatvicek, who was a rabbi, wrote a book called The Lonely Man of Faith in 1965. And it's a period piece, 1965, so I apologize for the non-inclusive language. He said there are two sides of our nature, which he called Adam 1 and Adam 2. I might call them Eve 1 and Eve 2, but he called them Adam 1 and Adam 2. Adam 1 is the worldly, ambitious, external side of our nature. He wants to build and create companies, create innovation. Adam 2 is the humble side of our nature. Adam 2 not only wants to not only do good, but to be good, to live in a way that internally honors God, creation, and our possibilities. Adam 1 wants to conquer the world. Adam 2 wants to hear a calling and obey the world. Adam 1 savors accomplishment. Adam 2 savors inner consistency and strength. Adam 1 asks how things work. Adam 2 asks, why are we here? Adam 1's motto is success, and Adam 2's motto is love, redemption, and return. Now, as much as we use live in a world that values the resume over the eulogy, And as much as we really do live that out in many ways in our community, much of the time our values and principles are love, redemption, and return. And it is sometimes difficult for us to live within that tension. Here's another way to look at it from the conclusion of Reinhold Niebuhr's book, The Irony of American History. Nothing that is worth doing can be achieved in our lifetime. Therefore, we must be saved by hope. Nothing which is true or beautiful or good makes complete sense in any immediate context of history. Therefore, we must be saved by faith. Nothing we do, however virtuous, can be accomplished alone. Therefore, we must be saved by love. No virtuous act is quite as virtuous from the standpoint of our friend or foe as it is from our standpoint. Therefore, we must be saved by the final form of love, which is forgiveness. Niebuhr wrote these words after World War II as he was trying to make sense of World War II and how it fit into his Christian faith. He was a professor of theology at Union Seminary from 1928 to 1952. And he was an influential voice on a wide number of issues, including politics and ethics and foreign policy. And he was a strong supporter of the American intervention in the war in Europe. But in 1946, he was a drafter and signer of the Federal Council of Churches statement that the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki was morally indefensible. And so what he had once supported no longer made sense to him. And that final statement in that book was one of his ways of making sense. We are saved by hope, by faith, by love, by forgiveness. And yet, is that enough? I mean, that sounds really nice and a little saccharine, right? Hope, faith, love, forgiveness. Is that enough in today's world? We who use don't talk about or really believe in evil. And we have a really hard time creating a consistent theology about it. And partially, I think that's because so much of the conversation in America around evil is really based in a conservative, dualistic Christian understanding that says there's the devil and there's God. And that's not us. And partially, we also really want to value the inherent worth and dignity of each human being we meet. And yet we know evil. We see evil. We hear about it every day. We experience it. I have conversations with you folks in this congregation. I hear how much each of you struggle with the tension between our UU value of staying in relationship while trying to value each person's inherent worth and dignity, and knowing that you have relatives and coworkers and neighbors who do not value your inherent worth and dignity, who judge you and attack you for your gender, for your orientation, for the color of your skin. These are people who other you every day. And it may be at times that the most you thing you can do when you are being directly attacked by an individual is to simply not engage. Affirming somebody's dignity does not necessarily mean that you must always talk to them or always be in relationship with them, no matter what the danger. Sometimes all you can do is try your hardest not to wish them harm. Take the Westboro Church, for example. That very homophobic and anti-science church that demonstrates at funerals and even at General Assembly. Demonstrates against the very values that we UUs hold so dear. It is hard to not call the Westboro Church evil. It is hard for me to get to a place where I am not actively wishing them harm. I try my hardest when I think about them to remember that individuals are not evil. Systems may be evil, but not people. And still Westboro. I fail more often than I succeed at that one. Now, I bring up Westboro because I heard Megan Phelps make some remarks about what she had learned as she left Westboro. And she learned this not from her family, the members of Westboro, but instead from people who had argued with her while respecting her humanity. Megan Phelps was born and raised in the Westboro Church and ultimately left. And she's spoken about how she has come to see the humanity of the other side, even while she was part of the Westboro Church. Interestingly, for all the ways we vilify Twitter and see it misused, Twitter was the vehicle that allowed her direct contact with the other. And it was the way that the others responded that eventually broke her heart open. She talked about how divided we are and how each side is getting more and more entrenched in their righteousness and the evilness of the other side. And she said, "What gives me hope is that we can do something about this. The good news is that it's simple. The bad news is that it's hard. We have to talk to people and listen to people we disagree with. It's hard because we can't often fathom how the other side came to their positions. It's hard because righteous indignation, that sense of certainty that ours is the right side, is so seductive. It's hard because it means extending empathy and compassion to people who show us hostility and contempt. The impulse to respond in kind is so tempting, but that isn't who we want to be. We can resist, and I will always be inspired to do so by those people I encountered on Twitter, apparent enemies who became my beloved friends." She goes on to say, "I thought about it a lot over the past few years, and I found four things that they did differently that made real conversation possible. These four steps were small but powerful." I'm going to give you those four steps in a shortened version. And know that no one of us can do all of these four steps all the time. And sometimes it really is too dangerous. Sometimes one's legitimate anger is too much. And yet, when they can be used, they can be effective. And so the first one is, don't assume bad intent. Assuming ill motives almost always instantly cuts us off from truly understanding why somebody does what they do and why they believe what they do. And we forget that they're a human being with a lifetime of experience that has shaped their mind. And we get stuck on that first wave of anger. And then the conversation has a hard time moving beyond it. But when we assume good, or at least neutral, intent, we give our minds a much stronger framework for dialogue. You see, their assuming good intentions is not necessarily assuming the person is good, but it allows your mind to start from a place where you can actually affect something. The second is ask questions. When we engage people across ideological divides, asking questions helps us map the disconnect between our differing points of view. And that's important because we can't present effective arguments if we don't understand where the other side is actually coming from. And because it gives them an opportunity to point out flaws in our positions. But asking questions serves another purpose. It signals to a person that they are being heard. And that is a way to value their dignity. The third is to stay calm. I think that must be the hardest. It takes practice and it takes patience, but it's powerful. She said that in Westboro, she learned not to care about how her manner of speech affected others. She thought her rightness justified rudeness, harsh tones, raised voices, insults, interruptions. But that strategy is ultimately counterproductive. Dialing up the volume and the snark is natural in a stressful situation, but it tends to bring the conversation to an unsatisfactory, explosive end. And finally, she says, make the argument. This might seem obvious, but one side effect of having strong beliefs is that we sometimes assume that the value of our position is or should be obvious and self-evident. That we shouldn't have to defend our positions because they're so clearly right and good, and if that someone doesn't get it, it's their problem, and it's not my job to educate them. But if it were all that simple, if all the positions were that obvious, then we'd all agree, right? We are all a product of our upbringing, and our beliefs reflect our experiences. We can't expect others to spontaneously change their own minds. If we want change, we have to make a case for it. Now, all of this may seem very far afield from how do you want to be remembered, my opening question. But if I am correct that our UU values lead us to value what gets said at our eulogy more than what is on our resume, that we value our relationships more than our achievements, then in this day and age, when our values are being challenged, when we are being encouraged to make the divisions among us bigger and deeper, we need a way forward. And these four steps that Megan Phelps laid out, assume good intentions until proven otherwise, ask questions, stay calm, stick to your beliefs and make your arguments, those are not the strategies of hate. Those are the strategies of hope, of faith, of love, of forgiveness. May these be the ways that we are remembered. May this be our legacy. In a world without end, may it be so.